Hello and welcome to Behind the Scams. I want to start out this episode with a psychological concept that is called cognitive load.
Okay, so you're going all Sigmund Freud on us, huh?
Well, psychology is an important topic, but this term is usually reserved for pilots, right? Or air traffic controllers. But I want to apply it to a Tuesday morning in Rockville, Maryland.
Set the scene for us.
Okay, so imagine you are listening to this right now and you are 81 years old. You are behind the wheel of a car in heavy traffic. But you aren't just driving. You have a passenger. It's your husband, and he suffers from Parkinson's disease. So you're heading to a medical appointment, you're monitoring the time, you're watching the road, you're listening to the GPS, and you're hyper aware of his tremors. Your brain is already operating at maybe 90% capacity, just managing the baseline stress of your reality. You're redlining. I mean, in psychological terms, you have zero bandwidth left for complex analysis. Yeah, you're completely in survival mode.
Exactly. And in that specific moment of maximum cognitive load, your cell phone rings, you look at the caller ID, and it says Rockville Police.
And that, right there, is the breach point. We often think scams work because the victim is gullible or greedy, you know?
Right.
But looking at the AARP fraud dossier and the FBI data regarding the case we are covering today, it strongly suggests that Judith Boivin wasn't gullible.
Right.
She was busy, she was distracted, and she was targeted by an industrial-scale psychological operation that knew exactly how to exploit that specific distraction.
So today, for our deep dive, we aren't just telling a sad story about an 81-year-old woman losing nearly $600,000. We're deconstructing a very virulent strain of fraud. The FBI calls it the hero trap.
It's a fascinating and frankly terrifying evolution in criminal methodology. We're going to look at how an Indian call center, thousands of miles away, successfully virtualized a Mexican cartel threat to basically hijack the mind of a US social worker. We're going to take apart the script line by line to understand the neuroscience of why she said yes.
Because that's the big question that kept me up reading these files. Judith Boivin wasn't trying to get rich. She wasn't buying crypto or looking for a quick payout. She was a nurse, a social worker, a woman who literally spent her life helping people.
Yeah.
And the scammers didn't steal her money by tricking her into a bad investment. They convinced her to give it up voluntarily to save the day.
That is the crucial distinction here. They weaponized her altruism. But before we get to the hero part of the story, we really have to look at the terror part, because the script doesn't start with a request for help. It starts with a threat.
Right, so back to the car. It's September 2023. Judith answers the phone. The voice on the other end identifies himself, the chief of police for Rockville Police Department.
Immediate authority. This is their first anchor.
He tells her, your social security number has been linked to a crime, but he doesn't even dwell on it. He immediately pivots. He says, this is too big for us. This is a federal matter. And then,
click, the line transfers. Now she's talking to a man who identifies himself as Wayne A. Jacobs, an agent with the FBI.
I want to pause on this transfer for a second. This is a classic escalation tactic designed to induce shock. They do not give the victim time to process the local police interaction because suddenly, boom, you're in the big leagues. You're dealing with the FBI.
And notice the specificity of the name, Wayne A. Jacobs.
Right. It sounds like a perfectly made-up G-Man name.
It does, but it isn't. If you Google Wayne A. Jacobs FBI, and I'm sure Judith did or would have if she wasn't driving, you will find a real person. He is a high-ranking official within the FBI's Washington field office.
That is incredibly dangerous. They're using a real person's reputation as a shield.
It's called credibility laundering. They take a verifiable fact of real person's existence and title, and they just wrap a lie right around it. It essentially hacks our trust but verify instinct. You verify the name, so you naturally trust the voice.
Wow.
So, Agent Jacobs drops the hammer. He tells Judith that her identity is being used by a Mexican cartel. And not just for anything. They tell her it's being used to launder money and traffic fentanyl. I feel like we hear that word every single day now. It's the boogeyman of the modern era.
It is. And that is exactly why they chose it. They are actively tapping into the cultural zeitgeist of fear. Everyone sees the headlines about the opioid crisis. Everyone listening to this knows about the cartels. By invoking fentanyl, they aren't just accusing her of financial impropriety. They are linking her to dead children, to overdoses, to a massive national tragedy.
And this brings us to the concept of the amygdala hijack.
I see this term thrown around a lot in pop psychology articles. Is it really that simple? Like a switch flips and you just become stupid?
Well, it's a bit more nuanced than a light switch, but effectively, yes. Think of the brain as having a power grid, like a city. Your prefrontal cortex, the part of you that does math, logic, skepticism, and complex planning, that part is a massive energy hog. It requires a stable environment and tons of metabolic resources to function.
Okay, so exactly what is it?
The amygdala is the emergency generator. When it detects a survival threat, and in 2024, the word cartel combined with federal charges is immediately processed by the brain as a survival threat. It initiates a resource diversion.
So it's a physical response.
Yes, it physically shunts blood flow and oxygen away from the logic centers and pushes it toward the motor cortex and sensory processing area.
So when people say she couldn't think, they mean she physically lacked the oxygenated blood in the part of her brain required to process the discrepancy in the story.
Precisely. You are biologically incapable of critical thought in that moment. This is why the timing of the scam is so critical. The scammer agent Jacobs hits her with the trauma. Dead children, fentanyl, prison, and he just keeps the pressure up. He cannot let her hang up the phone because if she hangs up,
her heart rate drops, the blood returns to the prefrontal cortex, and she realizes, wait, the FBI doesn't use Gmail.
It's a physiological hostage situation.
It really is. And to maintain that state, they used a very specific schedule. They established a routine where Judith had to speak to Agent Jacobs twice a day, morning and night.
Why twice a day? I mean, surveillance, I understand, but that seems excessive even for a controller.
It's about nervous system regulation. Remember the amygdala hijack we just talked about? That state of high anxiety is exhausting. The human body just can't sustain it forever. Eventually, you crash. By demanding contact every morning and every evening, Agent Jacobs is regulating her nervous system for her.
Oh, I see. She wakes up anxious, she calls Agent Jacob.
Exactly. He calms her down, he reassures her, he tells her she's doing a good job. She goes to bed worried, she calls Agent Jacobs. He slowly becomes the primary source of emotional stability in her life.
That is so twisted. He creates the poison and then he sells the antidote.
He isolates her from her husband, her friends, her entire reality, and replaces it with his voice. He becomes the only person who can lower her blood pressure. And to cement this bond, they introduced the secret language.
All right, the code word. The source material mentions she had a case number CP920416, which sounds super official, but they also had specific phrases she had to use to confirm her identity.
This does two things. First, it reinforces the us against the world dynamic. It makes her feel like she's on the inside of something secret and important. It gamifies the trauma in a way, right?
But second, and more importantly, it creates a psychological wall between her and everyone else. If she has a secret code with the FBI, she can't tell her husband because he doesn't have the code. He is an outsider now.
The code words create an in-group, and that in-group consists of exactly two people, Judith and the scammer.
It's like they drafted her into a spy movie. And the tech played a massive role too. She was getting emails with the FBI logo, documents that looked completely official.
With a subtle fatal flaw that a calm brain would have spotted easily. The emails came from a .com address, not a .gov address. But again, going back to the amygdala hijack, when you're terrified that a cartel is using your name to kill kids with fentanyl, are you checking the domain extension on an email?
Oh, absolutely not. You see the seal, you see the name Wayne Jacobs, and you believe. But here's where the story shifts. Up until now, this sounds like a standard fear-based scam. Pay us or go to jail. But they didn't stay in the fear zone. They pivoted.
And this, to me, is the genius, the evil genius of this specific script. They stopped treating her like a suspect and started treating her like an asset.
This is the hero trap, right? They looked at her background. Judith isn't just a retiree living in Rockville. She's a registered nurse, a clinical social worker, a licensed therapist. And get this, she spent time helping children with HIV, and she lived in Mexico for 3 years helping a priest establish a mission.
I want to pause on the how here. How did they know she was a nurse? How did they know she did missionary work? That seems incredibly specific for a random cold call. Did she just volunteer that info during the panic?
It's possible she dropped crumbs that they picked up on, but it is almost certainly not a random cold call. This is where we get into the lead generation market of the dark web.
Treat me like a novice here. I know companies buy data to sell me shoes or whatever. You're saying criminals buy data to sell me scams?
It is the exact same mechanism. There are legitimate data brokers who scrape LinkedIn, Facebook, and professional registries. They bundle lists like retirees with nursing licenses or seniors with high equity.
It's basically a cheat sheet on all her life connections.
Exactly. That's what analysts call the mosaic effect. One database has her nursing license, another, maybe a breach from a travel agency or a donation she made to a charity, shows an interest in Central America. The scammers buy these enriched leads.
Wow.
They aren't dialing random numbers. They're looking for a specific avatar, an empathetic, elderly professional with liquid assets and a history of charitable giving.
That changes the profile of the crime entirely. It makes it targeted.
It makes it spear phishing, not trolling. When Agent Jacobs got online, he likely had a dossier on Judith right on his screen.
He knew which buttons to push because he paid for the map to her psyche.
So they used this map to completely rewrite the script. Instead of saying, "You're in trouble," Agent Jacobs says, "Judith, because of your experience in Mexico, because you know the culture, and because you're a medical professional, we need you to help us take down this cartel."
It is a masterstroke of manipulation. They took her greatest source of pride, her history of service, and turned it into the weapon of her destruction. If they just tried to scare her, maybe she would have eventually hung up.
Yeah, fight or flight. She might have chosen flight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But by telling her she was needed,
yeah,
that she could actually save lives, that bypasses the too-good-to-be-true filter we usually use for lottery scams. Winning the lottery feels like luck, and we are naturally skeptical of luck. But being asked to help, being asked to sacrifice for the greater good, that feels like destiny for someone like Judith.
It appeals directly to her identity. It reconceptualizes everything, how she isn't moving money to save her bank account. She's moving money to protect it, so the FBI can use it as bait, or so the cartel can't get it all, in service of this grand mission.
Exactly. They told her the instruction to move money was protective custody for her assets.
Yeah.
But notice the narrative shift. She isn't saving her money. She is saving children from overdoses. Agent Jacobs told her the cartel was killing kids. Judith is a nurse. She's a mother figure. She simply couldn't say no.
So she's fully committed at this point. She is Agent Boy now, effectively. And Agent Jacobs gives the order, liquidate the accounts. She goes to Morgan Stanley, and this is where we get to the institutional standoff, because Morgan Stanley, they actually did their job right.
They did. They completely froze the account. They put a 10-day hold on it. They assigned two investigators. They looked at this 81-year-old woman suddenly liquidating her entire portfolio and said, "This is a scam."
Let's walk into the Morgan Stanley branch for a minute. This is the moment where the system should have worked. The bank did everything right. Why didn't it stop her?
This is the most frustrating and tragic part of the case file. You have two scripts colliding in that lobby. The bank teller has a compliance script, questions designed to trigger the Bank Secrecy Act protocols. Do you know the recipient? Are you under duress? What is this money for? Standard questions. They ask me that if I withdraw $5,000.
Right, but Judith walked in with a counterscript provided by the scammers. This is known as inoculation. Agent Jacobs told her the bank is under investigation. We believe that managers are laundering money for the cartel. When you ask to withdraw, they will lie to you. They will ask if you are being scammed. They might even call the police to scare you.
That is diabolical. So when the teller asks, "Ma'am, are you being scammed?" Judith doesn't hear a warning. She hears confirmation that the teller is dirty.
Exactly. The safety mechanism reinforces the trap. Judith becomes an actor. She uses the lines Jacobs gave her. "I'm renovating a house. I'm switching banks. It's a family emergency." She is actively improvising to defeat the very three people trying to save her because she believes she is the one on the side of the law.
She got angry at them. She viewed the compliance officers not as protectors, but as obstacles to her mission.
And that is trust displacement. The scammer has become the trusted authority. The bank has become the enemy. It effectively weaponizes our privacy laws. The bank cannot legally hold her money forever if she answers the questions correctly, even if they strongly suspect she's lying. If she's competent and demands her money, eventually they have to give it to her.
So eventually she wore them down, or the hold expired. The money was released. And this is where the deep dive moves from the psychological to the physical. It moves from phone calls to parking lots.
The logistics here are incredibly high risk, which really shows how confident the scammers were in their control over her. Once the money was out of Morgan Stanley, Agent Jacobs told her it needed to be held in a safety locker at a DC courthouse as evidence. He even gave her a fake locker number and fake State Department docu, but she didn't go to a courthouse.
No, she went to strip malls.
Let's picture this. It's November 2023. Judith has $20,000 in cash. I'm just trying to visualize the physical reality of that. That's a massive brick of bills.
This significant. Agent Jacobs tells her to rapid seal it exactly according to FBI specifications.
She drives to a random parking lot, and Agent Jacobs is on the phone the entire time. This is critical. He is tracking her in real time. "Turn left here, park there. Do you see the black SUV?" He is the voice in her ear directing her body.
She walks up to a black SUV. The window rolls down. She doesn't see a face, or maybe she sees a masked figure. The source says she just hands the package through the window.
And the window rose up and the car drives away.
Why? I mean, I know we talked about the amygdala hijack and the cognitive load, but handing cash through a car window in a parking lot, how does that not scream drug deal instead of FBI operation? Even in a panic, that visual is so jarring.
It does scream drug deal, but remember the narrative, covert operation. Agent Jacobs has likely told her, "We can't meet at the office because there are moles," or "We need to do this exchange in the field to avoid tipping off the cartel surveillance."
The absolute sketchiness of the drop is framed as necessary tradecraft.
It creates a cinematic tension.
Exactly, yeah.
The adrenaline of the moment, the fear, the tension, the looking over her shoulder, it reinforces the idea that she is in a movie, that she is doing something dangerous and heroic. If they met in a boring office, the illusion might fade, but the danger makes it feel incredibly real.
It's the excitement, it's the rush, and it happened 5 times, 5 separate drops. She moved money to 4 different banks just to get the cash out to avoid detection from the first bank's fraud department. In total, nearly $600,000 passed through those car windows.
That is just gut-wrenching. That represents an entire lifetime of work gone in a few weeks. And she's sitting there thinking she's done a good job, thinking she's going to get her new Social Security number and her money back after the trial.
Until January 2024.
The crash. She gets a voicemail, not from Agent Jacobs, but from the Maryland Attorney General's office.
And this time, it's real.
It's real. And notice the difference in protocol. The real authorities don't ask for money. They don't ask for secrecy. They call to tell you you are a victim. They tell her the truth. Agent Jacobs is a fake. The case number is fake. The money is gone.
I can't even imagine that moment. The source says she went into a shocked state. It's not just the money. It's the shattering of the entire narrative. She wasn't a hero. She was a victim.
She meets a real FBI agent later.
And this is the twist that feels like fiction, but is actual fact.
The real agent tells her, "My boss is named Wayne A. Jacobs."
So there was a Wayne Jacobs.
Yes. This confirms the sophistication we talked about earlier. The scammers used the name of the actual assistant director in charge. They did this so that if Judith ever had a moment of doubt and searched the name, she would see a face, a title, and the reputation that perfectly matched. It's identity theft used to facilitate grand larceny.
And the real FBI explains the geography of the scam. And this is something I want to dig into because it connects to some of the other research notes we have. Judith was told it was a Mexican cartel, right?
But the real FBI says no, this was an Indian call center.
This is a fascinating and disturbing evolution in global fraud.
Yeah.
We are seeing a hybridization of crime. You have call centers in places like Kolkata or New Delhi, tech-savvy, English-speaking, highly organized, industrial-scale operations. But they aren't just doing the old IRS tax scam anymore. That script is played out.
Right. Everyone knows the you owe back taxes call. We hang up on that immediately.
Exactly. So the criminal organizations did a market analysis. They looked the American psyche and asked, what are Americans afraid of right now?
Cartels, fentanyl, the border.
Precisely. So the Indian call center adopts a Mexican cartel narrative. It's a narrative overlay.
They're virtualizing the threat. They don't need to be in Mexico. They don't need to be cartel members. They just need to sound like they are fighting them.
It's essentially fraud as a service.
Correct. This is what intelligence analysts call criminal convergence. You have distinct groups in India hiring American scriptwriters or using AI to draft narratives that exploit specifically American cultural fears. They realize they can get the exact same compliance with the scary story about fentanyl that they used to get with the computer virus warning, only the payout is significantly higher.
It completely reminds me of the Aurora Phelps case mentioned in our research notes.
That's a crucial comparison.
Aurora Phelps was a physical predator. She operated in Las Vegas and Mexico, luring older men on dating apps, actually meeting them, drugging them, and sometimes kidnapping them or leaving them dead. That was physical violence, physical proximity.
Right. You have to be in the same room.
Exactly. Judith's case is virtual kidnapping, not of her body, but of her mind. The scammers in India never touched her. They never drugged her physically, but they drugged her psychologically, with fear and dopamine. They kidnapped her agency just as effectively as Phelps kidnapped her victims, but they do it from 8,000 miles away.
That is a terrifying thought, that you can be kidnapped while sitting in your own living room in Rockville.
And the devastation is entirely comparable. Judith lost her security, her trust in herself, her faith in her own judgment. The financial loss is huge, obviously, $600,000, but the psychological wound, that might never heal.
So what does this all mean for us? We've walked through the grooming, the trap, the bank, the drops. When we look at the aftermath, Judith is struggling, obviously, but for everyone listening, how do we spot this? Because Agent Jacob sounded so real.
He did. But there are structural red flags that are always present in these scripts, no matter how sophisticated the story is. We need to burn these into our brains.
Okay, let's list them.
Number one, the government, whether it's the FBI, the police, the IRS, the sheriff, they will never ask you to move money to keep it safe. There is no such thing as a safe government locker for your retirement savings. The Treasury Department does not hold escrow for private citizens. That's the golden rule. If they want your money, it's a scam.
Number two, the secrecy clause. If anyone tells you that you are under a gag order and cannot tell your spouse, your children, or your bank why you are moving money, that is a 100% guarantee of a scam. Real investigations do not require victims to lie to their families about their life savings. If the police tell you to lie to the police, they aren't the police.
And the asset lie, the idea that they need us to help them.
Yes, this is highly specific to the hero trap. Civilians are not recruited over the phone to be covert assets in federal money laundering stings. The FBI and IRS has highly trained agents for that. They do not need an 81-year-old nurse to launder money for them. It flat out does not happen like that.
It seems so obvious now, saying it out loud, but in the moment.
In the moment, with the amygdala firing, with the flattery, with a sudden sense of purpose, it feels completely real.
You know, we usually end these deep dives with a clear takeaway, but I want to leave you, the listener, with something a bit more provocative today.
Go for it.
We often look at scam victims and think, oh, I'd never fall for that. I'm not greedy. I'm not dumb. But Judith wasn't greedy. She was brave. She was helpful. She was the kind of person who runs toward a fire to help.
She absolutely was.
And that's what makes this script so incredibly dangerous. It targets the best parts of us, our compassion, our desire to be useful, our fundamental desire to protect children.
That's right. It turns our virtues into our biggest vulnerabilities.
So here's the thought I want you to carry with you as you go about your day. If a voice on the phone offers you a chance to be a hero, ask yourself this. Why does the hero have to pay the entrance fee?
That's the question. Real heroes don't pay to play.
That's it for this deep dive. Take care of yourselves and maybe call your parents today just to say hi.
And tell them you love them.
We'll see you next time here on Behind the Scams.
Goodbye and thanks for listening. And be sure and visit behindthescams.org and all major podcast platforms for more episodes.